When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, we're back with another bonus episode. This time we're talking about the Handmaid's Tale phenomenon on the occasion of the publication of Margaret Atwood's, I guess, long wonder. We didn't even know there. Let's put it this way. The Testaments came out. It wasn't a long lead time we had knowing it was coming out, nor were there many whispers. It had been so long since the Handmaid's Tale itself. I don't think. It's not in the next Game of Thrones level of anticipation. No one was really waiting on it. People wondered about it, but we didn't. Suddenly we had one. And
long wanted, shortly waited. Yeah. Awaited, shortly awaited. Yeah, we had about a year's notice this was happening.
Mm-hmm. Though Atwood apparently has been working on it for a while. We'll get into that in a minute. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to spend the first section of the show talking about The Handmaid's Tale, give a little background. We went back and looked at like what was it like on its own publication in 1986, what was the reaction like? What's its life been like then? What's happened of late? And then talk about our own experience reading The Handmaid's Tale, take it on its own terms. I reread it in anticipation of this. Then we'll talk about the Testaments in the second half of the show. In that part of the show, we'll do a few minutes of spoiler-free discussion, evaluation, review, recommendation, whatever you want to call it. And then we'll get into the book and think about the whole arc that we have now before us of The Handmaid's Tale. Okay, but before we do that, let's do a sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Scribner. Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman is a collection of seven stories in which characters pursue their obsessions on paths to glory and destruction, while all around them their worlds twist and warp, oscillating between reality and impossibility. On display throughout is Cotman's ability to reveal truths about the human experience, about things like friendship, love, betrayal, bitterness, all through whimsy, horror, and fantasy. Elegiac in tone, imaginative, and humorous in their execution, the character-driven stories in Weird Black Girls challenge, incite, and entertain. The author's last book was named one of NPR's Best Books of the Year and was a finalist for the Philip K. Dick Award, with reviews appearing in The New York Times, Wired, BuzzFeed, and Locus, among other publications. Definitely make sure to check out Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman. And thanks again to Scribner for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hero to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hero's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour.
Okay. You and I did some research about the initial publication of The Handmaid's Tale. Do you want to start there, or do you want to start with your own reading experience back way back in the when?
Ooh, let's talk about our own first reading experience.
Okay, you go first.
I would like to start there. I did not have to read this in school. I'm not even sure if I was aware of it as a thing. You know, like I have a degree in English, but never had to read it in high school or college. I first read this in the summer of 2008 when my very first book blog was a wee little baby. I have a very clear memory that I was visiting my parents. I had known that The Handmaid's Tale was a big deal. I picked it up because it was on summer reading lists that I was selling at Barnes & Noble, where I was working at the time. And I was like, okay, this is on a bunch of syllabi. I should know what this book is about. It's a like a modern classic. So I didn't have, like, that's all I knew about it. I went in totally cold. And I remember just being captivated by it. You know, 11 years ago, I was in my mid-20s. And being terrified, like, it's, the book is terrifying in a way of, and I think it's intended to be, but that was my first experience of it, reading it on my own. I think I wrote about it on my blog. I'm sure that I talked about it with the people around me of like, wow, she's really imagining the bottom of the, or on the way to the bottom of the slippery slope of what happens when women's rights are severely restricted for religious means, when religion takes over the government, and that it's in the book in sort of backlash to the feminist movement. It was really terrifying. I was also like just starting to understand in my adult life what my feminism meant. And so that, I remember that being very formative and just being struck by the thoughtfulness, and like there's kind of a thoughtful obviousness to some of the choices, like that the handmaids don't get to go by their names, but that they're referred to as of Fred, or, you know, of Kyle, or whoever they're, the commander is that they're assigned to, that like right down to your name, you're stripped of your identity and of your agency in this story. And that Atwood finds a way to strip the women at all the levels of the society of their sort of personal rights, even the women who appear to be powerful, was just bracing. It was a chilling reading experience. And I remember staying up really late in my childhood bedroom being like, oh my God. What about you?
I think I said on the show the other day, I read it either in high school or early in college when I was going through my read the things you haven't read but you know are things phase. And so I read it out of any kind of context other than it was probably on some list, right? It was like in the back of Harold Bloom's Western Canon or the greatest novels. It was one of those kinds of things. Where I picked it up out of context, that it, probably the Barnes & Noble in Lawrence, Kansas, or the Borders in Lawrence, Kansas, and a paperback edition. I remember it distinctly. And so without context, I mean, you clearly can tell it's a political book, but I really read it, my experience of it was more like reading a Faulkner or Morrison, which is you don't know what's going on, and part of the experience of the text is putting together how this world is, what world are we in, how is this thing working, what are the rules of memory and time, in Morrison and Faulkner, but in this one is really what are the rules of the society, and where am I in space and time. So I read it more of a, I don't mean this as a compliment or a slag, as an artistic piece than a political or feminist one, because it is stylized. It's not, I really liked The Hunger Games as a dystopian. Again, it's pitched at a different audience, but that's, you don't think of The Hunger Games as having a particular style. It's just a dystopia, right? It's a novel, has been a dystopia, where The Handmaid's Tale is told in a first person point of view from a person who's in distress, writing surreptitiously in snatches over time and isn't really sure what is going on, but maybe is, and also dealing with her own emotions on the page. So as that kind of a reading experience, it's remarkable. It's a remarkable reading experience in that way, because what Atwood does with voice and point of view is really remarkable, even outside of the world of Gilead that she creates in it. So I guess I came in it maybe inverted that way and only came later in graduate school and some other places to look at it as a, you know, a feminist text, a postmodern text, though I'm not sure it is, but that's maybe beside the point here. So that's always been my experience of it. As a dystopia, it's interesting. You and I once got into a very long discussion about science fiction versus speculative fiction, and Atwood was at the center of that, believe it. I don't believe Handmaid's Tale was the pearl around which this particular, the grain of sand around which this particular pearl of a discussion crystallized, but this is clearly a speculative fiction. It's not science fiction, at least in my reading of it in 1986. It was, this could happen tomorrow,
yeah,
which isn't science fiction, at least using my definition of it, but it's, the speculative fiction is what if something that doesn't currently exist or happen did happen. And that's interesting in its own right. So that's where I came in. My feelings about a dystopia, I'm not sure it's a wonderful dystopia. I don't think it's on the level of 1984 in that regard. But as a fable, as a cautionary tale, as a piece of imaginative fiction that's doing something, I think it has a lot of merit. But I think to judge it as a dystopia, as typically thought of, it doesn't hold up as well. Maybe we'll get into that. And I think actually The Testaments, frankly, throws a lot of that into relief. But Mary McCarthy's initial New York Times review, and maybe we should get into the background, I find myself nodding my head at a lot of it, though the overall dismissal is maybe strong, or maybe not, of the book I don't agree with. But some of the critiques itself I agree with, but maybe I'm missing the point, maybe McCarthy's missing the point, maybe we're all missing the point. It's interesting to look back at that now, because we all live in the post-Atwood Handmaid's Tale hagiography world. We were just talking about this before we got on the show.
Yeah.
So seeing the New York Times pan, there's no other way to put it, is a bit of a douse of water maybe needed and interesting to talk about there.
Yeah,
too.
It was really interesting going back and reading those reviews from the first publication. And what was, I think, most, perhaps most surprising is just how mixed they are. It's like a really, really mixed bag. There are some raves, there are some pans, there's some sort of middling stuff. I found a piece on HuffPo from not too long ago, from a couple of years ago, about what critics, this was after The Handmaid's Tale like surged in sales after the recent election, but about what critics said about The Handmaid's Tale back when it was released. And there's a good roundup of sort of all the varieties of the varieties and flavors of criticism and appreciation that we can put into the show notes. But like, if you had asked me based on the way that we talk about The Handmaid's Tale today and the place that it occupies in literary culture and the culture in a broader sense, insofar as like you can refer to like, man, it's really going to be like The Handmaid's Tale up in here. And most people, if they don't know the specifics, they understand that you're referring to like some bad thing is happening to women because of government restrictions.
Yeah, right.
I would have said it became this huge big deal. Probably the reviews were primarily good. And they really were mixed. And that Mary McCarthy review in the New York Times, as you mentioned, is fascinating because she opens with, surely the essential element of a cautionary tale is recognition. And then she goes on to spend a couple of paragraphs talking about how there's no shock of recognition for her in reading The Handmaid's Tale. It says, the book just does not tell me what there is in our present mores that I ought to watch out for unless I want the United States of America to become a slave state, something like the Republic of Gilead, whose outlines are sketched here. And, you know, I was 4 years old when Mary McCarthy wrote that review. Mm-hmm. I don't know what life was like for women in 1986 from lived experience, but as a woman in 2008 when I first read the book, and as a woman in 2019, like, I feel like the things we should be watching out for so that we don't end up in this place are obvious and have been obvious. And that was, it was just head scratchy to like, how did you get to this place where this is the quibble that you open with? I agree that some of her other critiques of the book are interesting and valid, and it's not a perfect book. But then again, like, most of the things that end up on the canon aren't perfect. They just end up there because of some larger significance.
Yeah. I guess one thing that struck me in reading it again, post really the ascendancy of The Handmaid's Tale to become an icon, and the figure of a handmaid is an icon now, which we should get into a little bit now. It's just The Handmaid's Tale is just much more slight than I remember. Like, in a good, and I think in an interesting way, like, it is one woman's, a handmaid, Offred's, you know, her one experience. It's over really only the course of a few months. You don't get perspectives from other characters. And I think it works in that particular way, but in a way where people want to build a dystopian framework around it. There's just not much there. There's so much we don't know about Gilead and how it came to be. That part of the McCarthy, I think I recognize, even if I'm not sure it's necessary. Like, how did this happen again? Like, there was a counter-revolution, and then, like, paramilitary people raided Congress, we're supposed to understand. And I guess there's a little bit of that hand-wavy stuff. And sometimes these kinds of dystopias work better where you don't worry too much about actually putting it in a time and place people recognize, like The Hunger Games is this weird Pan-Am. Okay, it's sort of America, but sort of not. Orwell's 1984 pushed it into the future where you could still recognize, you know, that you're in London. but it's far enough away where you're not kind of mapping it onto a specific place in time. And this is, like, the shorthand is, what if Puritans now and too much kind of is the shorthand for this. And how we get there is a little unclear. And if that's what you're thinking a dystopia should do, a cautionary tale to do, maybe it doesn't function on that level. Mm. But I'm not sure it is a cautionary tale. I guess that's another thing I wonder about. Like, is it a cautionary tale? Is it a fable? Like, what's the difference between a fable and a cautionary tale?
I think
I found myself thinking about a lot in the last few days.
I think it is the answer to what if. And Atwood talks about that herself in some of the pieces that I think we both read in preparing for this, that she starts with a what if. And I agree with the classification of it as speculative fiction. She even says, I made a rule for myself. I would not include anything that human beings had not already done in some other place or time, or for which the technology did not already exist. So she's not inventing, like, new science. It's not science fiction. It really, like, it's a what if. It's a speculation. I think I never got hung up in my reading in The Handmaid's Tale of, like, okay, what are the specifics of how we got here? Because it just seemed so believable that you could end up there. Like, that maybe there aren't, like, you know, in 2008 when I was reading it, we weren't specifically looking out for, like, Mike Pence to be on TV talking about punishing women who have abortions, but it's believable that a group with enough people like that could find a way to take power, and that if they did, this was the world that they would create. So I was satisfied by that, but I can see how if you're really looking for, like, a detailed plan of here are the specific things to avoid or the specific things to do to not end up in this place, it doesn't meet those needs. I liked the vagueness of it. Like, to me, that makes it scarier. And maybe we can talk about that in the Testaments and the way that the Testaments does tell some more of the history. But that, like, there are, it seemed to me when I read it the first time that there were so many possible ways that could happen. And it was so believable that we could end up at the bottom of that slippery slope, that her exploration of, like, what would it be like to be a person inside that, to be a woman in this particular situation, was really compelling.
I do wonder too, I think the point you made about what it was like, not to use Mary McCarthy herself, but a figure like Mary McCarthy, who is a professional woman in 1986, we're only 14 years on the other side of the row there. Right. And at that point, I can imagine it feeling like the momentum, the direction of women's rights and gender equality was expanding. I mean, even though Reagan was in power, elected, you know, I don't want to use the tyrannical words unnecessarily, but, like, it felt like the momentum was in one direction. And I think one thing that's brought The Handmaid's Tale into the discourse in a way now that it wasn't in, say, 1996, we weren't talking about The Handmaid's Tale, is we could feel that the contraction was possible, right? It's some of it's Trump, some of it's the Supreme Court, some of it's Tea Party. Like, we saw that initial wave after Roe and leading up to Roe, and it may have felt like it was impossible to turn the tide back the other way. And The Handmaid's Tale is a reminder, a cautionary tale, a fable, a what if, whatever you want to say, that it could come back the other way. This could be more like a pendulum than a comet. Well, I guess even comets can come around, depending on what you're looking at. But, like, maybe that's what she couldn't. Maybe in 1986, it felt like all the momentum is one direction, whereas another 20 years, another swing of the pendulum, another counter-revolutionary, you know, to use those account in terms of gender equality, wave certainly has rippled through. Or come to light. I don't know which one of those. Some people say it's more that's become more overt. It was always there, but people weren't talking about it. I don't know. But the idea that Roe could get overturned is kind of the reverse tipping point a lot of people think about. And that's why we see The Handmaid's Tale, the handmaidens, you know, at Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings out on the steps and stuff like that. Because people are saying, here's a, you know, if we're going to go back, this is one of the stones we have to walk on to get all the way back to, or back to what Gilead would look like in the future or something else like that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point and really possible. One of the ways that Atwood herself described the early reviews, at least in Canada, was that they were baffled and somewhat anxious. And I think baffled is a really interesting word choice there. And I would give Margaret Atwood credit. Like, I'm assuming that she chose that word for a reason, that if reviewers and readers were confused by why this kind of story was being told, or, like, picking up on the sense of anxiety from it, but maybe not clear on, like, why is it coming? Why do we have this book right now? Why is Margaret Atwood telling this story? What are we supposed to be afraid of? That does point back to like perhaps something in the water in the culture was different at the time that made it harder to imagine or less available, less relevant to just a rank and file reader to see themselves in these characters and to believe that this could happen to them. It's really interesting to think about.
I'm not sure how well it sold out of the gate. That's one thing we couldn't jointly find in the year since it sold millions of copies. Initially, it was a finalist for the Booker Prize. It won the Arthur C. Clarke Award and then really picked up steam really in the next 10 years after its publication in academia, especially in reading lists and in theses and dissertations as women's studies became more and more of a central piece of the humanities, if not the central piece, maybe, in the late 80s and early 90s. And The Handmaid's Tale was a, and remains, ripe for all the things humanities likes to do with artistic works. And that became, you know, generations now of graduate students and undergraduate students have read The Handmaid's Tale in an academic context and kept it, you know, relevant. And then the TV show and Trump. I mean, those are the other two things. We can't talk about Trump. Or we can't talk about The Handmaid's Tale without talking about Trump, and we can't talk about without talking about the TV show, who kind of at the same time reminded us, reinforced that we had a cultural icon, a cultural document that served as, I don't know, a flag, as a symbol, really, in a way that we don't have another one. We don't have another cultural symbol quite as powerful to represent retrograde anti-feminist ideas as The Handmaid. There's nothing even close as I was taking stock.
I think it's really singular in that, and not to say that no one else has done a feminist dystopia, which Margaret Atwood disputes the use of that descriptor, but I'm going to go with it. Mm-hmm. In that, like, the other big dystopian stories that we have are about, you know, some regime takes over. They're like, it's always about a group of people that want to remain in power and have control of resources. And the way that you do that is you get control of the people. But none of the stories up until this point, I don't think, were about specifically that the resource being controlled was women and women's agency. Not just like, to go back to the Hunger Games, not just like a group of wealthy people who wish to remain wealthy and keep everyone else down by controlling resources and creating competition between the people that don't have the resources, but very specifically a theocracy driven by a specific reading of the Bible that interprets gender to mean that men are just rightfully placed by God in positions of power, that women should not have positions of power, that the men should make all of the decisions and women should be subjugated to whatever the men in power choose, because that's the position God put them in. Like, you just get this sort of catch-22 feedback circle of why these women should be doing the things that they're told that they should do. No one had done that before. Like, that is very, that's the very specific thing that makes The Handmaid's Tale, I think, different and very scary, is it's not just like, what would it be like if the world as we know it ended? It's like, it affects men and women very differently. And this was a story that in the like sort of surge, as you're right, the like early surge of women's studies coming to the front of humanities was looking right at that of, you know, what happens when it's women are the commodity.
And I mean, the book is clearly the source material for the show, but I don't think we have Handmaidens on the step of the Supreme Court without the TV show. Like, that made that symbol recognizable and sort of like it's on CNN kind of way, saying Handmaid's on the Supreme Court steps. Without the TV show, people are like, what the hell, what is this?
Right.
I don't think it's not enough of a cultural thing to be usable as a totem of an idea of protest, I guess, is ultimately what it is. Interesting that, I think there's interesting too that the quietness, the subservience, the inarticulateness of the handmaiden has been taken up by the people who use that garb in those moments. Like some of the power is the silencing, the self-silencing, and just sort of standing for being subject. Like you are subject and you sit there quietly and you let people put onto you their reading and it does the work you need it to do.
Absolutely.
All in one. I looked around, I tried to find the first, or something about one of the early utilizations of the Handmaid's Tale garb as political protest. And I didn't come up with anything concrete. If anyone's ever seen anything like that, I'd like to know it. Like, maybe it was before the TV show and there was some other thing, but like, where was the prime mover for this more current wave of this kind of cosplay protest, which I've never seen before?
The very first reference that I could find, and I'm not sure that it's the first instance, was to women dressed as handmaids showing up at the Texas State House, I believe, in protest of an anti-abortion bill in March of 2017. So just on the heels of Trump's inauguration.
Mm-hmm. And then the book sold well when the show came out, but really it in 1984 shot to the top of the bestseller list in January. Around Trump's inauguration in January of 2017, I guess it would.
Yeah, one of the
seems like way longer ago.
Right, one of the numbers I saw about that said that I think that piece was also from like March or April of 2017. That during the election, sales of The Handmaid's Tale had increased about 60% over what they usually were, and that in the couple of months since the election, they had increased by 200%. I think that's tailed off. We're not still seeing The Handmaid's Tale as a bestseller every week, but people were turning in large groups to reading this book and to reading 1984 after Trump's inauguration. I'd be really curious to know how many of them were going to those books for the first time. That, cultural critics and political commentators and people writing editorials were referring to dystopia. They were referring to 1984 and to The Handmaid's Tale. And I would guess a lot of people who wouldn't have previously gotten the reference picked up those books and got it. And that's also one of the things that contributes to women being able to dress as handmaids, show up in protest of something and be recognized.
Let's see, anything else about, I mean, it's been banned. It's always been banned in various places since its publication. Let's say here, this was from Wikipedia. I think you and I got this from the same place. But in the decade of the 90s, it was the number 37 most banned booked. Mm-hmm. And then the 2000s, number 88. So fall from there. I wonder if it's banned anywhere now. We don't hear about this. You think we would hear about it if people are trying to ban The Handmaid's Tale, but we don't seem to hear about this when we pay attention to that stuff.
Yeah, and with the reasons it's banned are, I think, pretty predictable if you know the content of the book, that it's banned and challenged. It's explicit. Mm-hmm. There's profanity. There's sex. There's suicide. I found this quote to be very amusing, both defamatory to minorities, God, women, and the disabled. Like, just a mixed bag there. Of like, we're mad at this book for all of the things that it does. Interesting that it's been banned, I think, less and less frequently, or challenged less and less frequently since the 90s. But we've talked on the main show about how we've seen a shift in the content of the books that show up on most frequently banned and challenged books lists. And now the real shift is towards people are focusing on trying to ban and challenge books that deal with LGBTQ content and sort of the identities that are not, cisgendered heterosexual people. Like, that is the controversy now.
And younger books target younger readers. Like, I don't know that we're getting too many LGBTQ books for adults being targeted in high schools. So The Handmaid's Tale is clearly a book for adults and not about LGBTQ. So the target has shifted. I think, interesting, I was thinking about this too, that the target moving towards kids' books, towards LGBTQ plus stories and characters, as a sign, as sad as it is, of progress, right? Like, it's becoming, in order to challenge something successfully, you have to move down towards kids, towards the places where you feel like people are going to be more anxious. And that The Handmaid's Tale is farther up the reading food chain is interesting now to think about, where it's untouchable as strong, but it's not controversial. It's not on the table for discussion as being appropriate or not anymore.
Right. A feminist story isn't quite as offensive to people as it used to be, or it's just not as offensive as the existence of stories about gay people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, maybe as stories about gay people have become more prevalent, that's a target that people who are interested in such things are more interested in going after than The Handmaid's Tale. So maybe it's deflecting some of the attention that would be pointed at The Handmaid's Tale. I guess it's a good time to talk about subsequent critiques of The Handmaid's Tale as being, well, I mean, it's a critique and a description, right? To say it's a text of white feminism. I don't think many people would disagree with that who are interested in listening to this show, where people of color, women of color especially, are What are they? They're pushed off screen. I mean, the description we get in The Handmaid's Tale is that the children of Ham, which is basically all people of color, we're supposed to think, I guess, have been eliminated, moved to the colonies. Again, where they're going, were they all murdered? We don't really know. But they're not in these stories. They're just not. And one thing we had wondered about with the Testaments, that some attention might be paid to other kinds of identities. Spoiler alert, they're not.
Nope.
I don't know what let's save it. But in this context, that's some that in the initial rounds of reviews I was seeing, no one was talking about that in 1986. Into the 90s, that became more part of the discourse. Mm-hmm. And reading it now, I can't help but notice. I mean, even without knowing that was out there, I think I would have picked it up. It's like, where are the black people again? Like all of America, or like the whole, basically, I think Colorado to DC, from sort of Maine-ish all the way to Florida, is Gilead, and there's a lot of black people and Latinos and Asians, mm-hmm. and like what happened to all of them? We just don't get it. And I'm not sure what to make of that. I mean, there's a charitable and uncharitable reading. I'm probably somewhere in the middle. I think it's notable that the TV show, the director of the TV show, I've forgotten the name, said that recast the characters in The Handmaid's Tale that were obviously white in the book, and they're black families, black couples, black women. And he said, you know, is it racist? Is it actually being racist or reflecting racism to have a show all about white people? And I thought that was a really powerful kind of an idea. It's like, at what point does replicating racism by whitewashing the whole country be reifying of white supremacy in itself, even as it's trying to explain it? I don't know what to do with that at this point, but it's on the table. It's there. You can't not talk about it.
Yeah, I think it's really, it's complicated in the way that we think about we talk about race and representation is very different than the way it was in 1986. And our expectations of representation are very different. But like white supremacy and this like super conservative, twisted fundamental version of Christianity that gives rise to Gilead are very closely connected in real life. And the kinds of people like alive in the world in 2019 who would be inclined to try to create a Gilead, many of them would also be inclined to white supremacist views and to, you know, eradicating people of color mm-hmm. in some fashion, whether they would openly admit to it or not, or openly make a plan for it or not. And I think that if this book came out now, if The Handmaid's Tale came out now, that the whole, like, you know, children of Ham have been sent away would just require a lot more explanation.
It would get murdered. The book would get murdered. Am I wrong? And, it would get destroyed.
And I think there could be a story told about that. Yeah. Like it would be very believable and in line for the commanders and the people in power who run Gilead. You could tell a story about how they made these decisions and what was driving them. Like they're afraid of losing their power in all the ways. So women have to be subjugated. People of color have to be subjugated. Anyone who might rebel against them has to be subjugated. And you could also tell the story of how they go about doing that, or have a person of color character writing from one of the colonies, or, you know, there are a lot of ways that it could happen, but it would be essential. And it's, you know, like June's husband in the TV show, Elizabeth Moss is the main character, June, her husband is a black man, their child is mixed race. And that's like, that happens, but it also doesn't, you know, flesh out the whole world of the story. Right. The Testaments doesn't do anything for that either. I guess maybe for internal consistency, like you can't just add a bunch of black characters to Gilead after The Handmaid's Tale has happened.
When they go run away to Canada, there's no people of color anywhere. I didn't get it. Like it occurred to me that if the Testaments had been called The Children of Ham and it was about people of color, mm-hmm. I would have been like 9,000 times more interested.
Yeah.
But Atwood, I don't know what to say. That's not a club she has in her bag. It just isn't. I don't know what to say.
You know, I think she's just I have a less generous reading of this. I think she's kind of dug in. Like she has been asked about it. And my interpretation of her responses is essentially like, well, that's not what the story is.
But why?
Like, but I mean, that's not a good, it's not a good explanation. There was opportunity to do something in the Testaments that like she's, you know, she's fleshing out the world in mm-hmm. which this happens. And she very easily could have made the choice to have characters of color on the page to talk about what happened to the people of color in the United States when Gilead took yeah. over. Like, she could have decided to do that, and she chose not to. And I think that that deserves to have a lantern hung on it and to be criticized, like mm-hmm. to dig in, because you just don't want to have to care about the criticism or about the fact that the world is different than it was 35 years ago when the first book came out. Like, you know, Margaret Atwood's on the record in several interviews addressing this and addressing related issues in ways that are not awesome. Mm. And folks in Canada, like one of our Book Riot contributors is a Canadian lit scholar, and will say things like, us up here in Canada have been telling you guys for a long time that Margaret Atwood is your problematic fave. And I think she's solidified that for me in some ways by failing to address it at all in this new book that is a very big deal, that's getting a ton of publicity, where she could have taken some corrective steps.
Yeah, because, I mean, I certainly, in my rereading of The Handmaid's Tale, I had that lens in mind. And, you know, you get the sense in the, well, not the sense, you get the proof that there are resistors, marginalized people, they're Jews and gay men, especially, mm-hmm. it seems to be, and Catholics. Like, they get hung up on the wall, like their bodies are on display. And even among those, there are no people of color. Like, that's what really struck me. It's like, I'm not sure it would have been quote unquote fine for the only appearance of a black body to be hanging dead on a wall, but at least it would have acknowledged that they exist, that their own disappearance was remarked upon or policed or anything. I mean, some people, there's a very strong narrative that the story of American identity is a story of white supremacy. And this one, by centering exclusively white women's experience, really does that narrative and that thinking a great disservice, mm-hmm. and a misreading, I think, an oversimplification, even as it's sort of thinking complicatedly about ideology and theology. It just omits such a critical, deep, important, painful part that it's so hard. It's hard even to think about, except as, and I guess this is another thing worth saying in my experience of it, other people's mileage may vary. As a book that came out in 1986, as a historical document, as part of the canon, you can say, well, the conversations just weren't there in the way that they are now. Take that for a wheel. It doesn't excuse anything. It's just what it was, right? That we weren't seeing those critiques in 1986 in the reviews tells you something about the world Atwood was writing in 1984, 1985. Mm-hmm. But that's not the world we live in anymore. Yeah. It's just not.
Yeah, I think to be a relevant work of, like, cultural significance, and not every book is trying to be a relevant work of cultural significance, like, and that's fine, not every book needs to be, but in order to be that now, to be, like, especially a dystopia that attempts to ask what if some really bad thing happened in our world, what would it look like, you have to take an intersectional approach. And Atwood didn't do it in 1984 for all of the reasons that we've already discussed. The world was different, but she made an active choice to not do it this time around, and that's telling of some things.
I guess I should say, I'm not saying it's that you shouldn't critique The Handmaid's Tale for its, I don't know, whiteness. You know, it's just different than this.
Yeah,
like, it's like tenfold.
Yes, it's tenfold
the problem
worse now
in the
I
Testaments
agree.
Than it mm-hmm. would be thinking about Handmaid's Tale in
1986. Sure, because not only are the criticisms out there now, but she's been directly asked the question, and she has answered the question and has just chosen not to go there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that is what it is. We don't know what her motivations are, but that is the choice that she's made, and right. that reveals something.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'll get out on this. Like, I think The Handmaid's Tale will endure as a 20th century classic. And it will endure in the way that classics do, as the conversation around art and literature and ideas and politics does, which is it will be seen as of its time, remarkable mm-hmm. in its own way, but also bearing the, you know, stamp of its time, for better or worse. You know, I love Gatsby. Gatsby got problems. Huck Finn. Huck Finn got problems. We're not asking things for it not to have problems. But by bringing it into the future 30 years, into the discourse 30 years, without acknowledging that the world is 30 years later in this particular way, mm-hmm. It does. It is one of those situations where I do think it actually makes The Handmaid's Tale itself look worse in light than if this Testaments thing has not existed. But let's get to that. Any last words on The Handmaid's Tale before we move on? I feel myself wanting to move toward
this. Yeah, Testaments I'm ready now. To move on. Let's do it.
Let's do a sponsor and let's talk about the Testament.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant rivals to lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by W.W. Norton and Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Jillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties in low-threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Jillian Linden, and thanks again to W.W. Norton and Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode.
Okay. So anyway, that's where we're at. So the Testaments has brought, I don't know, one thing it serves to do, forget about what's actually between the covers of the book, I think, is brought The Handmaid's Tale's world into our current political moment. I think that's inevitably true. You can't read the Testaments like it's 1986.
Right, no.
And I think a lot of the discourse around the Testaments is going to bear that out over time. That's my gentle way of putting it. But I guess we're going to do a few minutes of non-spoilery talk. That's mine. I think in a way it doesn't do much to me to add towards the Gilead Handmaid's Tale achievement. And if anything, it highlights the blindnesses of the Handmaid's Tale writ large. There's some interesting stuff that are going. It's very readable. It's a page turner. Weirdly, more of a thriller, I'd say, than anything. Yeah, you want to know what happens, and almost a spy book, I guess.
It's super plot heavy in a way that's very different from The Handmaid's Tale. Yeah.
And Atwood herself has said in interviews about it now that, you know, people have asked her. Because the end of The Handmaid's Tale, you get the weird, I mean, we didn't talk about the textual document itself, but at the end of The Handmaid's Tale, you get the minutes from a Gilead Studies symposium, which is taking place some many years after Gilead has fallen, looking back on Gilead as a historical period and The Handmaid's Tale as an actual document, right? That Offred actually wrote and left somewhere. And they're considering this story in the context of Gilead Studies, saying that, so the text is saying that Gilead was over at some point, and the thing that came after Gilead was sufficiently sophisticated, and however you want to use that, to have academic conferences about Gilead. And one of the questions she always got, because she told us that Gilead would fall, was how did it happen? How do we get from Offred getting into this van with Gilead itself seemingly flourishing, or at least not in imminent peril, to that conference? And the Testaments really is the story of three main characters coming together to bring Gilead down, that's the story, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the broadest way to describe it. And the synopses online don't spoil who any of the characters are, but I think we can say that one of these three central characters is a character that features prominently in The Handmaid's Tale, and we find out that person's perspective and their experience. And it is surprising and different than the role that they play in The Handmaid's Tale. But it's a very different kind. It's just a very different kind of book. It's super plot heavy. You're not spending a lot of time with the characters' internal lives, with their thoughts, their fears, their wishes. You get some plotting on from the character who's kind of a spy doing secret things and contributing to attempting to bring Gilead down. But it's a really different reading experience. And I agree with your assessment that The Handmaid's Tale is going to continue to be a classic and stand in the canon, understood as a book that was written in the time that it was written in and seen through that lens. And I think it's an important book for that reason. That kind of story needed to be told. We needed a what if about, we needed a feminist what if in speculative fiction in the way that Margaret Atwood did it. I don't think that The Testaments is going to do that. Like, my sort of broad assessment, well, I guess we're getting into the meat pretty soon, is I don't think that this story needed to be told, and I don't think that it's going to last. There's just not, like, it's an enjoyable enough reading experience. You turn the pages and it's compelling to find out what happens, but there's nothing like existential to what's happening here. Nothing surprising in a like think about your own life, think about your place in the world kind of way. There's a lot of detail and a lot of story. But it's just not, like, if you're looking for a similar reading experience to a similar feel to what happened to you.
Stylistically, it's completely different. Yeah, the tone is completely different.
Yeah, sitting down to The Testaments is going to be very different from how sitting down with The Handmaid's Tale was. And I think, like, to that end, there's a high likelihood of readers being disappointed by a sequel to The Handmaid's Tale that is so different in so many ways. The genre is different. The tone is different. What she seems to be trying to do by even writing this book is very different. And it just, like, I don't know even that I would have, I probably would, because of the work we do, have read it. But I think I would have read it eventually. I wouldn't have read it like the week that it came out. I think I would have waited to see, like, sort of how is this book going to land, and then gotten to it after the buzz died down, come to it on my own. I think that's just sort of the reader service piece of, like, this part of the podcast is, like, moderate your expectations, I guess, or know what you're going into The Testaments looking for.
It's not a slog. I think we both ripped through it because it's plotty. Like, there's this is happening and this person is going here and we're getting a hint that there's something and blah, blah, blah. So in that way, but I guess the question of what it's about, I was left scratching my head a little bit. Like, whereas The Handmaid's Tale had a message, and it was kind of a meta message. Like, because it's out of time and space in a recognizable world, it wasn't like, look out for this particular kind of legislation. It wasn't like that. It was in the vein of 1984. Here are some large trends that, if they coalesced, if they left unchecked, left unexamined, could be the seeds of a very different world in which we lived in. Now, so all that's already established. So what work does The Testaments have left to do? I guess I have my own reading of it, but I find myself surprised that this is the book we got. Again, I don't think it's bad. I think it's readable. I think that the enormous blind spot willing or not of non-white, non-cis-het experience, especially even two, is completely gone. And even holding that out for a moment, I'm still not sure what the book is about. I'm just not sure. I have an idea, but I think we have to get into spoilers. So maybe one last non-spoiler thing, or should we get right to spoiler talk?
I'm ready for spoilers.
Okay, let's do spoilers. What's this book about? Like, can we do a generous reading? Like, why do this? Like, we both have our trepidation, like, striking while the iron is hot. People are wanting to do it. Let's assume all that Atwood actually has an artistic thing she's trying to do with this book. I don't know if we believe that or not, but, like, let's say that that's our prompt, is to say, what is the idea of the book?
I think that the idea in the most generous reading here is Atwood wanting to answer the questions that readers have had over the years, or being inspired by those questions of how did Gilead fall? Right. And Margaret Atwood doesn't do things in a linear fashion. Like, if we were probably wrong to ever hope or expect that we would get a return back to the feel and tone of The Handmaid's Tale. Like, she likes to do things differently and think about things differently. And this is a way to return to the world of the story, to flesh out the world of the story in a way that, the more that I thought about it, felt similar to me of how Oryx and Crake and The Year of the Flood, two of her other books, go together. She talks about them as meanwhiles for each other. They take place in the same world at about the same time, but in different locations with different characters and a little crossover. And this builds out the world. What happens with the, we're going full spoilers now, right? So like what happens with one of the main characters is Aunt Lydia, who's like the one of the primary villains of
if not the villain,
and she's certainly the villain of, I've only watched the first series of the show, but she is the villain of the first season, at least, of the Hulu show, and played like terrifically and terrifyingly by Anne Dowd. But
like, what a great part. I mean,
right?
As, like, as a villain to go, a wonderful, juicy part.
And but. That it turns out that Aunt Lydia is not only a villain, or not entirely a villain, but that she has been, we find out how she ended up in Gilead. And so that, like, I thought that was fascinating. Like, being in her experience of being a woman who's powerful. She was a judge. She was educated. She had never been married and never had kids. And so she's exactly what Gilead is afraid of. And being with her on like the day that Gilead took over and following that trajectory and getting to see her decision making from day one of like, I'm going to go along with this, but I'm going to like find my way to be as powerful as I can inside this system and ultimately overthrow it. And that that takes decades. And that was, I think, a really interesting thought experiment. And I it's interesting always as a reader to be asked to find compassion for a character that you previously were taught as the reader to, you know, to detest. And so I think Atwood wanted to go there of like, what would it be? What would it be like to be one of the powerful people in Gilead? And to be trying to make the overthrow happen, how would you overthrow it? I don't know that she had the answer to that question when she wrote The Handmaid's Tale. So trying to answer, like, how could you take it down? Who would have done it? And to try to do that with at least one character that was familiar to readers. I think that's kind of what it's about. But it doesn't, to me, this is not a book with a big message. I was saying to a friend like just an hour ago, like, I don't think every book has to have a big message.
No, but
you expect a book in The Handmaid's Tale family to be a
it's a high bar, Rebecca. I mean, that's what we're talking about. It's a high bar here.
Yeah, it is a high bar. I'm not sure there's a message at all. It's a book with a story. Like, what's it about? This is one of those books that you answer what's it about with what happens in the book.
Yeah, I mean, to use other cultural references to frame Lydia's arc, it's like a, I guess what's the biggest, like Snape. It's a Severus Snape sort of a story where bad, you think bad. It was bad for a while, or Snape is a little bit different because like Lydia was subject to Gilead in a very brutal way at the beginning. We follow that. Then became a cog, and then her critical consciousness then re-engaged. Like, she kind of went into survival mode, and survival meant going along and doing a lot of really bad stuff, right? And then at some point she started collecting nuggets, pieces, rumors, favors, compromat of various kinds.
She's never converted all the way in her heart to Gilead.
No. It maybe went dormant. But it also, she was looked like a duck, walked like a duck for long enough that she was a duck to some degree. But you get, there's that satisfying, you know, Darth Vader, Severus Snape, other things that you get the turn. It's not only, it's just, it's the person who is central to the evil of the story turning makes the overflow of that evil even more satisfying somehow. Like that's very, it feels to me very like visceral to have that person at least in the beginning, because we get Commander Judd and some Commander Kyle and other people, all the men, the commanders are all very one note. You know, that's not a critique. It's just true. But to have Lydia be the one who in the Handmaid's Tale, you felt the most revulsion for because it felt like she was traitorous to women herself, and how could she? And blah blah blah. But to have that turn around, I think is satisfying, almost like in a fan service kind of way. And I don't mean that as a pejorative sometimes, but it has a very sort of primal satisfaction to have Lydia be the one to turn the whole thing on its head.
I agree. And one of the questions at the heart of this is like, how could a person become Aunt Lydia? How could a woman do this, to do these horrible things to other women? And we get a lot of answers in the testaments. And I think that does connect to current discourse, in that you see around protests and around, you know, fascism and all of the sort of current political discussions, you see people say things like, well, everybody thinks that they would have fought the Nazis. Everybody thinks that they would have helped hide Jews in the 40s. But you don't know if you would have unless you've been in a situation like this. And like Aunt Lydia, as the woman she was before Gilead happens, you would never have looked at that character probably, or that person, and said like, oh, well, when the totalitarian regime takes over, she is going to go gently. And she doesn't go gently, but she goes, and we find out how. It's the regime is compelling and terrifying and awful and abusive. And you begin to have some sympathy, I think, compassion for this is how it could happen. And maybe there's implicit in there a beat of this could probably happen to me. I want to think that I would fight Gilead. I want to think I would be the resistor or a member of Mayday, but we're being asked to consider that many other options exist and are very likely.
Well, her world is so blown apart that survival, an interior survival of any kind of critical consciousness, is a kind of resistance, at least for a while, right? And she sees some women, or at least there's one other woman she sees who sort of actively resist in a moment and is immediately killed. Right. And I think in that moment we see her realizing that if I really want to do something here, getting killed right now is no good to anybody. I mean, it's not put on the page in that way, but she does, certainly not good for me. But it's also not good in any sense that, you know, I'm going to turn on this guy right now and shoot him and then immediately get the gun down. Like, what's that going to do? And she starts playing the long con, though it's also clear from the book she enjoys being at the center of her own narrative. Like, she's writing a narrative. I mean, there's another thing about the book too, the way it's put together. It's basically three documents. One is Aunt Lydia's monograph, or holograph is what it's called, the Ardua holograph. It's basically her writing surreptitiously what's going on for a future generation, she hopes to get it. And then a post facto, post Gilead fall testimony of the other two women who be central to this story, which I found myself much more scratching my head about. Like, I feel like if Aunt Lydia's story was presented, not even the same style, but the same like central way as Offred's was in The Handmaid's Tale, maybe that would be a little more interesting. But all this stuff about baby Nicole and Jade, Rebecca, what are we doing with that stuff? Why does baby Nicole matter again? Help me remember.
Because Lydia needs something to be plotting about in her method of overthrowing Gilead, but I do think this is a cockamamie plot.
It's a real MacGuffin thing. So for those of you who haven't read it, apparently there's a real problem. And I think this is one of the places that fleshes out the real, you know, extra Gilead world in an interesting way, that there's a lot of people trying to get out of Gilead, and there's a lot of people outside of Gilead trying to help, and the borders, you know, I think the border stuff feels more germane in a lot of ways than a lot of the other things that are going on here, trying to get people in and out, and how do you do this, and
how
do you
do it responsibly. The underground female road.
The underground female road. Not for black people, by the way. They don't get there, even though it's named. Anyway, that's a separate
situation. Yeah, I had a little note in the margins that was like, seriously?
Seriously, yeah. Let's whitewash and co-opt at the same time. Cool. Anyway, and so this is a thing that happens too, we know, in American life, where the disappearance of one usually white girl becomes a national story, right? It's JonBenet Ramsey. It's, you know, whatever Nancy Grace used to talk about 10 years ago on CNNBC.
Still JonBenet Ramsey.
It's still JonBenet. You know, like that one missing white girl becomes a national obsession. It's a Lindbergh baby. This is not new. And for Gilead, it's baby Nicole, who was ferreted out of Gilead from a powerful family. And not the only one, but for whatever reason, this one became the totem for like 16 years, right? It disappears as a baby. We find out that she's been in hiding in Canada, Winnipeg, or outside Winnipeg or somewhere, being raised by a couple of resistance. Mayday is the counter, you know, basically.
And that, like, Gilead. For a decade and a half, Gilead has been, like, hunting through Canada, trying to still find baby Nicole and bring her back.
And how, and eventually she's identified. We don't know how. This is, it's very confusing to me. And for whatever reason, so bringing baby Nicole back was going to be a big coup for Gilead, and especially Commander Judd and Aunt Lydia, whose power seems to be slipping for reasons we don't understand. But it was going to be their reifying their power and finally sort of sweep away their descent. And but Aunt Lydia uses this moment to snuggle the now young woman, I guess. She's 16, is that right? Yeah. Something like that. Back in, reunite her with her half-sister, who's been raised as sort of part of the Gilead system. She kind of believes in it. Her own critical consciousness is fostered by Aunt Lydia. They're half-sisters, and then they run away with the micro dot of documents to Canada, and that's the ball game. That's enough to do it. I can't piece it together. I have to be honest. I don't understand why this matters. Like, I don't understand why baby Nicole matters to what the micro is. It the micro dot? Is it baby Nicole? I don't get it. I don't get what it is about. This micro dot has all the compromat Lydia's collected over time, I should say. She gets it out with baby Nicole, whose name now is Jade, and her half-sister, and they go, and I guess they take it to the press, and then that's it.
Yeah, the closest I could get to why does this matter, at least in the world of the story, is that, like, Aunt Lydia gets the satisfaction of making everybody think that she has brought baby Nicole back and that Gilead is going to be successful. And then she gets to stick it to the man by it turning out that baby Nicole was, like, working against Gilead the whole time and has snuck out and is part of the resistance and is releasing this information that's going to bring them down. But of course, we don't ever, like, see that happen. Throughout the story, you do get snippets of, like, what kinds of information is being leaked out, because Aunt Lydia tells us about the secrets that she has on all of these powerful people. And the two girls, what is her name? Agnes is the one who's grown up.
Yeah,
she's grown up in Gilead. She is supposed to be married off to Commander Judd and gets out of it by claiming to have been called to service as an aunt, which this apparently is also a path that girls can take, that once you have, like,
I thought that part was interesting too.
We should also say, if we haven't said it already on this, we said it on the regular show this week, all of the trigger warnings in the world for this book,
you're so right,
all of them, but explicit scenes of sexual abuse of young girls, and that once they have their first periods, they are considered to be old enough to be married off and have kids. And we get to see, like, you can already imagine that that's terrifying and awful, but we are with some of the young girl characters as this happens to them, as they are abused by men in power, and also as they find out that they are going to be married. They're sent off to the class that tells them what's going to happen to them in marriage. They're all terrified of the penises that are coming for them, and rightfully so. And if they can't or won't sort of tamp down all of their fears about those things and get in line and do what a nice young girl in Gilead is supposed to do, they can freak out. And one of the responses to that is that the aunts may come and, like, we don't want her to kill herself, because you find out that the girls committing suicide to avoid being married to old men is a thing. They don't want to keep losing women to suicide.
Bad PR for the patriarchy to have these young girls killing themselves.
Right. So we'll let her say she's right. We'll let her say she's had a call to become an aunt, and then we'll see if we can assimilate her into this kind of system. I did think it was interesting getting to follow Agnes, like, going down the path of becoming an aunt, in that she's never been allowed to read. Like, what is it like to read, and then to discover reading all the secrets of the people in Gilead and actually reading the Bible, and then being scandalized that what's in the Bible is not what she's been taught is in the Bible. And what does that mean for all of the things that she's believed about how the world is supposed to be? Like, I would have liked more there, but now I'm like way off the original question you asked, which is, what is this baby Nicole business about? And I don't really know.
I don't really know, because we're given to believe that some combination of baby Nicole leaving Gilead, being identified, plus basically a Snowden drop of compromat, you know, a WikiLeaks. I mean, frankly, it's not that different, right? A WikiLeaks, a massive WikiLeaks style thing brought down the regime, which I don't get why a microdot without baby Nicole wouldn't work, but maybe it's me. Maybe I'm just missing it. That's one thing I didn't really understand. The other thing that struck me is, like, like 1984, like many great dystopians, like Hunger Games, you know, the other ones, they usually, or the most interesting ones, I think, in terms of thinking about politics, are figuring out totalitarianism, like fighting against, representing different kinds of totalitarian states. 1984 is a surveillance state. Hunger Games is a, I don't know, an entertainment totalitarianism, right, of its own kind. And this one is a patriarchal, theocracy totalitarianism. And again, I'm not a great scholar of these sorts of things. But in the real world, totalitarian regimes are generally brought about widespread populist movements, right? In the Bolshevik Revolution, that's people. In when the Berlin Wall came down, it was people, massive quantities of people in the streets. And it's interesting to me that Atwood's imagination here about how to break down a totalitarian regime is not a populist one. It is basically a sleeper cell, got the MacGuffin to the right people, and that did it. Which seems to me a fantasy of some kind, right? Like, if you only could do the right action, an individual could do the right action over time, you too can bring down a totalitarian regime, which I think is wish fulfillment of its own kind of way. That's one thing I came away wondering. I was like, this doesn't seem to me to match up with historical antecedents for how totalitarian regimes come down. This is more of a, if you only get sort of Agent 009 to do the right thing, then you too can bring the whole thing down, which I thought was an interesting message. I wasn't sure what to do with that.
Yeah, I think it made for a good story, but it's, and I'm not sure it's intended to be a message about how we bring down regimes, but it stands in as one, whether it wants to be or not.
Whether it wants to or not, the message here is one turncoat, one good, whoever's got Trump's tax documents, if you just put it on a disc and I don't know.
And also a kind of like, you might think that some of the big bads are just big bads, but one of them might also secretly be working from the inside. Like it's just a little, it's very confusing because I agree. Like the way that Gilead would probably be brought down if it could be brought down is like all the women have to get together and decide that this is over.
The arduous hall that the halls basically become coffee houses, like they were in, like, you know, and they became sources of foment that were protected. And
there's a...
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, and that there would be a kind of symmetry to the story then that Gilead happens in response to a feminist movement that these very conservative Christian people perceive to be out of control. Women are too big for their britches. Something must be done. They make Gilead, and there would be a very satisfying symmetry to Gilead is brought down by women in the streets revolting, again, taking back power. And that would have been a look at the cycle here of like that this is how these regimes rise up, as they take over in response to some movement or to some group of people having more power than they think that group of people should be allowed to have. And they are brought back down by the people taking back the power.
Right. Kind of an expansion and contraction of where the power resides, one of the few and the many, and the few and the many, kind of a back and forth. So I don't know. I guess if you had asked me how Atwood might represent, narrativize, storify the end of Gilead, I don't think I had my money on a cache of documents to Canada.
Yeah.
I just don't. It's just,
I don't either.
I'm surprised about that. And I'm not even sure if that's a critique. I'm just surprised, I guess, right now.
Yeah, it's just, surprising that, like, if the press releases last year announcing that this book were coming had said, and it will be about how Gilead was brought down, we would have been on this podcast, like, hypothesizing about how that would go.
Plausible scenarios.
Our top 10 guesses would not have included a sleeper cell run by Aunt Lydia and a WikiLeaks situation. I just don't think it would have happened.
And I wonder in 1984, I mean, again, people are the products of their time and place. Knowing that Atwood wrote The Handmaid's Tale in West Berlin in 1984 makes so much sense. Like you're really next door to a totalitarian regime that built a freaking, literally built a wall.
Literally a wall.
Literally a wall that becomes so emblematic in The Handmaid's Tale and The Testaments too, where you're on the other side of a totalitarian regime doing what totalitarian regimes do to enforce the kind of subservience and total control of your life experience. Like that's... It becomes hysterical is the wrong word in this context, but it becomes like a caricature of itself. We'll just build a wall around Berlin. Like, what do you, that's never going to work. Like, it might work for a little while, but the means of control eventually are so ironclad that they cannot hold. You know, they're strong, mm-hmm. but they're ultimately brittle because of how totalizing they're trying to be. And this, we don't get any sense that if Aunt Lydia wasn't around, that there was any meaningful rank and file discontent. Like, there's resistance fighters, like in Vichy, French resistance, but there's not any, I don't know, not like you would even see that she had antecedents for, like in East Germany. You just didn't see anything at all like that, which I wasn't sure what to make of. Maybe a populist movement makes for a bad thriller. I don't know. I don't know.
But like, it didn't have to be a thriller. Like that she made the choice to make the follow-up to The Handmaid's Tale a thriller is its own kind of question. I think I'm walking away from The Testaments with more questions than I have answers. And sometimes that's a really enjoyable reading experience of like the continued wondering. In this case, I think the book is intended to answer the questions. It's intended to tell you how Gilead falls and who's responsible and how this might happen and what life was like for other people in different parts of that world of Gilead. And it does answer those questions, but it doesn't answer like the spiritual need that's left by The Handmaid's Tale.
And spoilers here, just to show you like how much of a thriller it is. And if you don't want to know, don't listen. You've been warned. Like the climax of this book is being smuggled out on a boat and rowing to shore, like with the cargo. Like this is something out of like the end of A Farewell to Arms, or you know, a bunch of spy novels. Like just get to the shore, get the boat. Like it's almost, I don't know if it's a commentary on that. I don't know if it's borrowing that, but like Jade and Agnes rowing a boat to safety was just so almost genre, I guess, is what I'm saying. And the genre's not bad. It's just I'm still trying to wrap my head around the choice to do that to be so, I don't know, formulaic is the word I keep coming back to. I'm hesitating to come up with something better.
Yeah, I am also. It was like for all the ways that this book moves, and we did both rip through it, it's not really exciting. And the ending is certainly not exciting. There's a lot about it that is formulaic. Like spy stories do have certain formulas, and at its core, right, this is like a spy thriller. But it just didn't do it for me. I think like the central question about The Testaments that it's probably our job to answer, at least for ourselves here, is if you love The Handmaid's Tale, should you read The Testaments? I think no.
I don't know about, I mean, should is tough.
Like, would you recommend it? Are you going to recommend this?
I think if you like The Handmaid's Tale, you found it meaningful to you, and you're interested in The Testaments, I would say it's interesting. I don't think it's not a bad book. It's just different than what I was expecting. Ultimately, I think I was unsatisfied. I think I'm glad I read it. Is that an answer? I'm glad I read it.
That's interesting.
But I like interesting messes, and this is an interesting mess. Like this is like case, you know, docket number one in interesting messes.
I think we're going to shake out differently there. Yeah. I like interesting messes too, but I found this to be more mess than interesting.
Or is it even a mess? I mean, that's the question. Is it even messy? It may not even be messy.
It feels like a mess in some ways. Like I think
it's almost too tidy, maybe is what I'm saying at the end.
Yeah,
it's too tidy that a micro dot and baby Nicole on a boat brings down Gilead.
Yeah, which is its own kind of mess. Like a too tidy ending. Yeah, it's its own kind of mess. I think like it didn't affect, you know, like a new thing related to a thing you love does not recast the thing you love. And so like this did not make me appreciate The Handmaid's Tale any less. It doesn't change my feelings
about
that book. Right. It also didn't deepen it. I don't have a continued desire to spend time in this world. If there's a third book, I am not excited about the existence of the existence of that. I don't think that you need to read this book as a person who loves The Handmaid's Tale. I don't think it will harm your memories of The Handmaid's Tale. It does flesh it out in some interesting ways, but like if I get, and I'm sure that I will get, like, you know, DMs from people in my regular life who are like, or, you know, texts from people, or my husband's aunts at Christmas will be like, wasn't there a new Handmaid's Tale book and should I read it? Mm-hmm. My first blush response is going to be like, you know, you don't really need to.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's not like that. In a way, it's a much different book and the circumstances are completely different, but it's sharing the same emotional response of having to go set a watchman mm-hmm. in that regard. Like, it's interesting. Would I be sad if tomorrow I woke up and it didn't exist? Not really.
Yeah. We didn't need this book.
No. You're right too, that it didn't feel suspenseful, largely because the narrative is put together as documents, and two of the documents are witness post-action debriefs from the two women who nominally are in peril, but we know they survived because they're giving testimony to someone that's not Gilead, so they got out somehow. Mm-hmm. So some of the tension of will they make it or not is evaporated, because if they didn't make it, they wouldn't be giving the testimony, right? I mean, right,
I'm
not sure.
I hadn't even thought about the organization of the book in that way, but yes, that completely, like, that's what eradicates the suspense. And it could have been, you could have taken the exact same text, but made Aunt Lydia's parts like the first, you know, 60% of the book, and then done the turn of, and like, we could have had her talking about the girls, talking about her plan, like getting baby Nicole into Gilead, and then right up until the moment that she gets them out of Gilead. Right. And then we could have flipped perspectives to those two girls and been with them in real time, maybe even in flashback to how baby Nicole ended up in Gilead and to mm-hmm. how Agnes ended up becoming an aunt and then moved up to that moment that they run away from Gilead and are trying to get the WikiLeaks thing to happen. Mm-hmm. That there would have been some suspense to that story, but yeah, it didn't feel like, you know, that they're not ultimately in peril, and that made it feel less like a thriller, if that's what mm-hmm. it's supposed to be. I think that's one of my central questions is, what is this book supposed to be, and like, what genre did Margaret Atwood intend, like, what genre universe did Margaret Atwood intend for it to live in? And I'm just not sure. Like, not that things have to fit neatly into categories, but this is a hard one to talk about, because it feels like it is a little bit of many things, but I don't know what it intended to be. And evaluating a book or any piece of media, it helps to start from the place of, like, what did this intend to do, and does it fulfill that mission? And I just really don't know.
I mean, if Atwood's desire was to have a page-turnery story about the TikTok of how Gilead fell, it pretty much does that, I guess. I guess that part too. I think, you know, some of the things I liked about the book were that the three main characters whose stories we get are coming at Gilead from different relationships to Gilead. One who's mm-hmm. lived outside of it her whole life, one who came to it later in life, and one who grew up entirely within it. And the collision of those three perspectives is interesting to think about. And I like the way that was put together. You know, we could do a whole thing about the consequences of a document text where you're presenting the documents of the text as sort of quote unquote real documents in the world of the text. Cause Lydia, one thing Lydia is trying to do, there's, she hides her own journal mm-hmm. in the journal of John Henry Cardinal Newman, who was a 19th century theologian who wrote later in a life an Apologia, which was basically an explanation of his conversion. And that's what Lydia is sort of doing. She's doing her own version of, you know, so the symbolism, again, you have to know 19th century theologian/poets, which not everyone does, but you can look it up. is very much an apology. She's explaining to posterity in the form of us why she did what she did.
Yeah.
And you know, it's, I'm not even sure that Lydia, she actually becomes very non-complicated in a way. Because we sort of understand that the whole time she was playing a bigger game mm-hmm. and there were sacrifices to be made along the way, which undercuts some of her tyranny in the Handmaid's Tale. I'm not sure if I read Handmaid's Tale now. It's like, does the Aunt Lydia we get there map to? Is she the Aunt Lydia we know yet?
That's a good point.
I just don't know.
You definitely should not read these out of order. Like,
That was going to ask you too. Can you read the testaments without having read The Handmaid's Tale? I don't think you can. Yeah, I think it would be freaking lost.
I think you'd be pretty confused. Yeah. It doesn't stand by itself. And like, I would not advocate for starting with the testaments and then going back to The Handmaid's Tale if you have not already read The Handmaid's Tale.
I don't think so. Yeah. What else do you want to say? Anything?
Man, I think that's it. I'm really curious about other reader responses. Like, one thing, the book's only been out for a couple of weeks, but internet chatter about like the actual contents of the book seems relatively quiet, which might be its own kind of message about the reader response to it. But yeah. Shoot us an email if you've read this, if you have thoughts, questions, if hearing about it affects your perspective on whether you're going to read it or not, like all of the above. Is it useful to our listeners also to like hear a deep dive?
Oh yeah, we haven't done one like this before. Yeah,
about a new book.
Yeah, we'd like to know if this was interesting. What
tell
else
us
we could
all
do.
The things, podcast@bookriot.com.
I definitely liked reading it with this episode in mind of like how to think about it. That was really interesting to me. So thank you for doing this at the same time, even if we wish it was maybe something other than it was.
Yeah, I liked that experience too. It actually that helped me get through it when I like when I got far enough into it to be like, this is not going to give me like the spiritual things that I'm looking for from a second Handmaid's Tale book. It was okay, let's put on the lens of like how to talk about what this book is supposed to be or might be in culture. What is it trying to do? What might readers like or not like about it? That getting out of my own reading experience and into a bigger framework was really interesting. So I'm glad we did it.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to think of what fans of The Handmaid's Tale especially would like this. I think if you really would like to find out how Gilead went down, like if it was meaning, like if there'd be some catharsis and like Gilead's, you know, we know it's going, how did it really go down? That might be interesting to you. I guess I got the sense in the first book because of the coda that the thing wasn't there anymore. The Handmaid's Tale really wasn't about Gilead specifically, right? I mean, that wasn't the interest, I don't think, to me. It was like what Gilead represented. We knew it doesn't exist, so that it didn't exist in this non-real future didn't seem like the stakes were that high to me. So maybe that's another thing I'm coming. It's like, I knew Gilead didn't exist, and whatever terror it invokes was, you know, mapping it onto the world in which we live. And in the fictional world, we knew it was going to go away sometime. So I don't know. I needed the line, the dots connected for me. But if you were like, I really wanted to see Gil, I want these frickers to go down. maybe that will be interesting. I mean,
maybe
I can see that some segment of readers will find that good. Podcast@bookriot.com. You can find show notes to this and all back episodes of the Book Riot Podcast at bookriot.com/listen. What's coming up in these bonus episodes? We should tell people about.
Next one is our first crack at like sort of the. I don't know if we're going to call it Win at Book Club or the Book Club Breakdown, but we are going to read Where the Crawdads Sing.
We are. You've read it.
I haven't.
I'm 15 pages in, and knowing what you have read and some other people that I think my taste is more aligned with, I'm not sure that's going to be a real upper either. We're going to find another interpreter of maladies at some point. So we're going to be doing Crawdad. So if you've been thinking about reading that and, you know, want to read it there, or if you had read it, you can look forward to that. Then after that is Shawshank. Book Nerd Movie Club,
that's
Shawshank
gonna
Redemption.
That's going to be a nice one. That'll be feel good.
So you think I'll be 6 hours long or 8 hours long for Shawshank Redemption?
How many snacks do I get to bring?
So many scenes.
I'm so ready. It's going to be good.
And I guess we're going to have some audience participation stuff coming up later, but I'll just tease that now because we don't have the infrastructure to accommodate it.
Right. At some point, you might be able to do something.
Yes.
The next
boy,
two
that's really
are,
alluring. You might be able to do something at some point. We got that one.
Yeah. So, the next two are we'll talk about Where the Crawdads Sing, probably the larger phenomenon of that, and also give you lots of spoilers if your book club is reading it and you want to talk about it.
Just want to know about it because people are asking me about it. I need the episode of Win at Book Club, Where the Crawdads Sing.
Well, good news for you, Jeff.
It's funny. You're like this too, where people who are, you know, maybe more typical readers, like they'll read books, but they're not doing the kind of stuff we care about or listeners of the show care about. Anyone who's in that circle expects me to have read every book they've ever heard of. Not that the books that they've read, any book they've ever heard of. So everyone is asking me, either what did you think of the Where the Crawdads Sing? Oh my gosh, I love the what's the deal with the Where the Crawdads Sing? So we need some answers. It's really we're doing work for ourselves and making content out of it. Maybe was one way of describing what we're doing. All right, that's the big the best selling single day book of 2019, The Testaments. I was thinking about if we'd had these bonus episodes last fall, what books would we have done?
Ooh,
would we have done Becoming?
I don't know.
That was my big question. I was on the fence. I'm not sure we would have, but that's.
I think it's harder to do this with a memoir, but who knows? Maybe we'll end up doing it with a memoir.
Yeah, whose memoir? If not Michelle Obama's, there's not going to be a long list. Right. We're not going
to
do it with that
one. If we had been doing this in like 2017, we would have read The Nightingale to try to find out what's up.
Yeah, I was thinking about a list or something like that of like the most readable book club hits. You know, because some of them are pretty good and some of them aren't. Like The Help, please pass. Please don't read The Help. But like,
Ooh, maybe we could do a revisit of some of the Oprah picks.
But like, what are the best ones of those? What were the best ones of the Oprah picks?
I don't know, because the last time that I read them, I was like 17.
And you just liked whatever. And you're like, wow.
Yeah, I liked whatever Oprah liked because I wanted to be a grown up. Yeah, yeah. So maybe we can take a
Paradise,
take a
I guess.
Back.
That's a cheat. That's a cheat. Well, Paradise is probably the best, but that's a cheat. But I mean, of the stuff that shows up on paperback favorites, sort of the one hit wonders, you know, that had the Oprah book or the big paperback.
Sure. Like you got the Wally Lamb, the Yaya Sisterhoods.
Great. Perfect one. All those. The Lovely Bones.
Ooh, we could do a Doesn't Hold Up about one of the Wally Lamb books.
He has a career, I guess. Do people buy Wally Lamb books now? There's a new Wally Lamb book coming out tomorrow.
Booksellers, hit us up.
Yeah. I guess I should go to Barnes & Noble. Like, what right now is on that paperback favorite? Interpreter Maladies is there. Mm-hmm. It's often there.
Well, we got some research to do.
Ooh, if you go into a Barnes & Noble of late and you see the paperback favorites table, take a picture and email us at podcastofbookriot.com. I'd love to see what's on. Are they all the same? I don't even know this at Barnes & Noble's.
No, they have the some required titles, or at least when I was at Barnes & Noble, you would get like some titles that had to be there that I assume were there for like publisher placement reasons or because they sell well or both. And then whatever spots were open, you could do like discretionary with books you had enough copies of.
Okay. Anyway, the call is out. Take a picture of the paperback favorites table at your local Barnes & Noble if you find yourself out there. If I'm at a Barnes & Noble, I will take one and we can talk about that at some future show. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. This is fun.